John, I was wondering if you could just give us a little overview of the industrial workers of the world and what's coming up that's really important about it.
The IWW, of course, is celebrating our 100th anniversary this month. We were founded back end of June 1905. Right now we have a number of organizing drives going on around the country, including one up in your neck of the woods with couriers in the courier industry, an industry-wide campaign that we've been running for a little over a year now there. We have a big campaign among immigrant truck drivers on the West Coast, mostly immigrants, due to short-haul trucking. There have been a series of wildcat strikes out there. And in Stockton, California in particular, we've lined up a solid majority of the workers who haul cargo in and out of the rail yards there, and we have committees working in some of the other rail depots up and down the coast and ports as well. We've got some campaigns going among retail workers here in Philadelphia in other parts of the country as well. So we have a lot of activity underway doing organizing, and we're also looking back at our 100th anniversary and drawing lessons. A lot of the organizing we're doing now in a lot of ways harkens back to the kinds of issues we were addressing 100 years ago when the union was founded.
Well, yeah, I think there's probably a lot of real parallels to the situation now. I mean, people see it all the time. It just seems like we're reliving sort of the robber baron era, and I would hope that we hit the progressive era here soon.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. That, you know, when we were first founded, I think union density was maybe even higher than what it is now. And the idea of global capitalism as we're currently experiencing it didn't exist, you know, to the extent that it is. And certainly one thing that we consider a lot in the union right now is what kind of organization is needed to deal with the power that the boss class has amassed over the last 100 years. And that's something we'll be looking at quite seriously at our conference.
It's pretty interesting, all of the parallels now. What is there about the IWW that makes it perhaps an effective alternative to the rest of the unions that we have?
I think right now, well, throughout our history, the main thing that set us apart is that we're a union that doesn't believe that there ought to be such a thing on the planet as a boss. And our organizing has the aim of setting workers on a path where we, as our preamble says, create a new society in the shell of the old. And workers, there's no such thing as too much power for workers. So in contrast to the mainstream of the labor movement, which more or less is about simple wages, hours, and working conditions, and believes that working people and bosses have things in common, and bosses are going to look out for workers, and the idea that if a company does well, workers are also going to benefit. I think that history has shown that bargain is not, you know, that relationship does not exist, that companies can do as well as they want, and there's no promise to workers who make the wealth that those companies own. So, but I think in terms of our organizing, the models that we use, I think, help set us on a path where we can realize a society without bosses, but it also is what makes us interesting today. So historically, we have never relied on labor law to give us the right to organize. The union was organized before our current regime of labor laws existed, and now our organizing also says, you know, you want to make a union? That's the worker's business, not the boss's business. So we tend not to go to the labor board or to other governmental bodies for certification. Sometimes we'll go to them for protections offered to workers, but not for certification. And we tend to organize around grievances and issues. So rather than ask, you know, do you want the union, yes or no, we immediately assume that people want to organize around things that need to be changed on their job, and the question of do you want the union, yes or no, comes more naturally instead of in an election type setting.
Okay. Let me see. What I'm kind of interested in is you set up several questions right there in that statement, and that is a world without bosses. How could that operate? How do we get there from here? And how can the IWW operate and help workers outside of, I don't mean being lawbreakers, but without using the normal National Labor Relations Act type campaigns?
The real question, I think, is how unions can function using the National Labor Relations Act type campaigns. Unions never file for an election without having two-thirds or three-fourths of the workers. Most unions require more than that before they go to an election, and still the employers win more than half of all elections because the system of labor law is entirely rigged in the employer's direction. And so what we're looking for are ways that workers don't turn their power over to bureaucrats who spend months and months holding hearings and scheduling elections and then holding hearings on the elections. And, you know, it's a process that's never ending if you let it be. We're looking for ways in which workers can exercise their power day to day on the job. And so, for example, in California, the truckers have been waging this struggle over wait times, the times that they're required to wait before their trucks are loaded up, because they're paid by the load. They're not paid by the hour. Every hour that they spend waiting is time out of their life. It's also money out of their pocket. And people have, you know, been waging short strikes over that issue. They've been holding meetings. They've been using all sorts of strategies to bring pressures on the boss to say, we won't abide. You know, if you want to have truckers driving for your company, you can't let the wait time go over this amount of time.
And in fact, they have been successful in lowering the wait time by an hour so far.
Something I'd like to bring up in respect to these truckers is that actually as owner-operators, they are really completely outside the American labor system. So I think they're a really interesting example of what the IWW is working on. What kind of strategies and tactics do we use in this type of situation? You said some wildcat strikes. I would think that also, even though it wouldn't really apply to this situation in that sense, they are not really able to be a legal union, that they could call some kinds of boycotts that regular unions couldn't.
This question of whether they're legally independent contractors or not, we don't accept that as settled. I mean, there's a lot of workers in these ambiguous situations where the employers call them contractors, or they call them assistant managers or managers or professionals or temps or whatever. And it doesn't necessarily reflect the reality of what they do. So, yeah, these people, by and large, own or lease the cabs that they haul the trucks on. But they don't control their work. They don't control their scheduling. They don't control the wages. It's not clear that they're even, it's not a settled question whether they're entitled to the alleged protections of labor law or not. But leaving that aside, the bosses need that cargo to be hauled. And they need it to be hauled quickly. They get charged if it sits in the rail yard or if it sits on the port side. A lot of the cargo is perishable, and if it doesn't get moved pretty quickly, it can be quite expensive to the employers. They need it to go where it's supposed to go when it's supposed to go there. And that means that the people who are hauling that cargo, they have a lot of power just intrinsic in the nature of the jobs they do. And the question is sort of organizing them, strategizing about how to use that power in ways that force the bosses to pay attention and to make concessions.
Oh, okay. Yeah, they can strike at, use direct action to strike at a particularly vulnerable part of the economic chain, more or less.
They are at a particularly vulnerable part of the economic chain. That cargo is rolling off those trains, and it's stacking up in that yard. And on the other hand, cargo's coming in from all these other warehouses and plants and other modes of transportation and needs to get into the rail yard. and they have to have that cargo moving steadily. The last time there was a Wildcat strike that was coast-wide, it took them weeks to get the various depots, the transit hubs, operating again. Employers lost millions of dollars. It's a just-in-time economy where they need that cargo to move. When it's scheduled to move, they can't have it sitting around, and they don't have any place for it to sit around. The bosses have developed this economy to sort of squeeze out every cost they can, but in the process of doing that, they've made a lot of vulnerabilities as well.
Yeah, one thing that I think is interesting about the contemporary IWW, and you know, this relates to the strikers too, is that you're working with a lot of workers that definitely haven't been organized before. Could you talk about a couple of your other campaigns?
I can talk about the campaign that we have along South Street in Philadelphia, which South Street is a commercial corridor, somewhat touristy, where there are a number of, there's 350 retail and restaurant establishments, and about 2,500 workers work in the corridor. And the workers there have decided that since there's very high turnover in a lot of retail restaurant type work, they've decided that they're going to make a network of solidarity among people in the corridor. And what that's meant is that we have assumed the right to represent people in forms of, you know, what we actually have a corridor-wide grievance committee, we call it. And when we encounter workers with problems, we have our grievance committee go to the boss and say, hey, you know, we're the union for this whole corridor. Here's how we want to resolve this problem. And we've been successful in getting things like, in this low-wage service work, there's all kinds of just gross violations of law, not to mention just downright crummy conditions. So sometimes we found a group of workers who weren't being paid for all the time that they worked. The store would close at midnight, but they would be expected to stay on the clock for another half an hour, 45 minutes to clean up. And we were able to rectify that situation, and now they're paid for every hour they work. We were also able to deal with people who had been threatened with firing for standing with their coworkers. In a particular case I'm thinking of at the moment, a worker who had been injured had his hours cut, and his coworkers were organized to get him back his hours, and the person who had been injured was told, well, you're going to be fired if you talk to your coworkers. So we used a combination of direct action and legal filings to keep him from being fired, and 2 years later, still has his job, and he's stronger than ever. So I think it's an interesting model in that a lot of these folks have been deemed unorganizable because the turnover rate is so high that if you were to run a traditional campaign that relied on certification, by the time you got a contract, if you got a contract 2 years later, it would be a completely new workforce at the place, and you would have to completely rebuild those strengths. What we're trying to do is turn that dynamic on its head and say, you know what, you join the union as a worker, and you take it from job to job. So we've been building and growing there.
Yeah, and I also believe you're working with bicycle messenger services.
It's actually the whole courier industry, which includes people that do walking and driving deliveries as well. In Chicago, there's a committee of messengers. I think the most interesting work that they're doing is their industry is rapidly turning into an independent contractor-based industry. So rather than these messengering companies having employees, they are having the workers absorb the boss's cost of doing business, and workers no longer have things like unemployment insurance or workers' comp or so on. A lot of this is being fueled by a company called NICA, the National Independent Contractor Association. And they are simultaneously a consulting company for employers that want to pass their cost of doing business off onto employees, but they also pose as an employee organization or an independent contractor association. And in some cases, companies that go NICA require their contractors to sign up with NICA for NICA insurance, which, as you might predict, seldom pays off. And I think the Stop NICA Committee is a combination of workers who are already independent contractorized and people who are still employees and want to preserve that situation. And they have successfully kept NICA out of two establishments so far and are coming up with strategies to turn back companies that currently are NICA into employee outfits.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's one thing I learned today. I'd never heard of NICA. And I was just, while you first started talking about it, I was thinking, yeah, they probably sell the insurance to the employees, too. Yeah, that's just dastardly. But anyway, I was thinking perhaps maybe we could get back into a little bit more of what I find the just really fascinating history of the industrial workers of the world. I mean, man, they're... just so much happened with these people. I mean, I talk about IWW history quite a bit on the show, and maybe, John, you might want to fill us in a little bit about the development of the union.
The IWW was founded back in 1905 by unionists, people who had been in the labor movement for a long time and had become increasingly despairing of the strategies that were being employed. The labor movement at the time had this focus around organizing what they thought of as skilled workers. Sometimes it's hard to tell who's a skilled worker and who isn't by looking at them or the work they do. It's often more a mindset. You have people who get college degrees through telemarketing today, and so that must be skilled work, right, because they require a college degree. But... and, so this notion of skilled has always been strange. But anyway, the AFL-type unions weren't organizing what they thought of as unskilled workers, and they weren't organizing immigrants because they didn't think of them as proper workers, and they weren't organizing women. They were turning their backs on huge sectors of the workforce. And at the same time, they were trying to develop this sense of labor management cooperation, sacred contract, the early labor movement. The mainstream labor movement at that time had this notion of trying to create harmonious relations which would be embodied in contracts and binding arbitration or grievances and such forth. And this was a labor movement that by design excluded the vast majority of workers. It was also a labor movement that by design contemplated that workers would for all of our lives be subordinate to the employers, to the employing class. And huge numbers of workers just rejected this model of unionism. And there were a number of alternative unions that were out there that had been struggling with these kinds of conceptions, and several of them came together in June of 1905 at the founding convention of the Industrial Workers of the World. So you had the Western Federation of Miners that participated, which was an industrially based mine workers union, based primarily in the hard rock, metal mining kinds of copper, silver, gold kinds of mining. A heavily immigrant workforce relied heavily on community struggles. You had the American Labor Union, which had grown out of the American Railway Union, which had been an attempt to organize all rail workers on an industrial basis rather than organizing the brakemen in one union and the conductors in another and the engineers in another and the people who kept the track going in another, to have them all in one union so that they would support each other's struggles instead of helping the boss fight each union one at a time. You had a number of other unions. The brewery workers had a strong delegation, the people who brewed beer. The AFL had been trying to divide them up so that the people who brewed beer would be in one union, the people who drove the beer from the brewery to the pubs would be in a different union, the people who made the barrels would be in another union altogether. Because they had this notion that every craft should have its own union. So at the time, the AFL had a union called the Green Glass Bottle Blowers Union. And there was also a Blue Bottle Blowers Union and a Clear Bottle Blowers Union, you know. So you divide up the workers into these little tiny unions. And so a number of unionists and unions came together in Chicago to form a union on this alternate principle, this principle that we should organize industrially, that is to say that all workers in an industry should be in the same union, should fight together, recognizing the principle that an injury to one is an injury to all, that you needed a union movement that organized immigrants, that organized women, that organized the so-called unskilled along with the skilled, so that the entire working class was lifting itself up together rather than being pitted against each other in wage wars. And that was, you know, the basic premise of the union, and then also this notion of abolishing this class of employers who live off the labor that we do. I'm trying to create a situation in which working people ran industry ourselves and benefited from the product of our labor instead of working to enrich others. And based on that, we launched organizing drives in a number of industries, built up a fair bit of strength early in the union's history in textile, in agriculture, in timber workers, in the Pacific Northwest, such forth. So, for example, in the Pacific Northwest, where we had a very strong base among timber workers there, they had been working 12, 14-hour days. They would go from camp to camp. There were no facilities, so they would haul their bedding with them. There were no laundry facilities, so the bedding wouldn't get cleaned. And you can imagine, you know, the sort of diseases and parasites and, you know, such that accumulated as you go from job to job with no laundry facilities and no bedding and no sanitary. And so they decided that they wanted to change these conditions, and they won the 8-hour day by a very simple expedient. They brought whistles with them on the job, and they blew them at the end of 8 hours, and they quit work. And the boss would fire them, and they'd go down to the next camp, and the workers at the next camp who had done the same thing would go down to that camp and, you know, just shuffle the workers around, and the next day they'd blow the whistle at the end of 8 hours, and pretty soon everybody worked 8 hours because there wasn't a thing the bosses could do about it. And they did the same thing with the bedrolls. They just gathered them up and burned them one day and told the bosses, from here on out, you're going to provide bedding. You know, we're not going to haul it around on our backs. And so they transformed those conditions by taking direct action around the grievances that they had. Never negotiated contracts, but they completely turned the working conditions in the industry around. IWW also organized longshore workers. We had the first integrated locals of longshore workers in the United States. Had a fairly strong job presence up through the 1940s, although we were not as strong in the 1940s as we were, say, in the 1920s. Thousands of union organizers were thrown in jail between the outset of World War I and the late 1920s under criminal syndicalism laws, under espionage laws, such forth. The government took the view that to organize a union that fought for workers' interests was a violation of the war effort, and so thousands of people were thrown in jail for that. Many Western states passed laws that said that advocating the notion that workers should control industry themselves and take direct action to address their grievances was what they called criminal syndicalism. And so thousands more of our members were thrown in jail on those sorts of charges. They were still prosecuting members of the IWW on criminal syndicalism charges as late as 1969, before the law was declared unconstitutional. And so, you know, we had this continual trajectory of struggles on the waterfront. We had a very major presence on seafaring vessels through the 30s. In the 1940s, we did a lot of work, particularly in metal machinery kinds of shops, but also organizing, for example, maids, women who were cleaning buildings. They called them charwomen at the time.
Something else I was thinking about with the IWW was a wider impact. It had, I guess, perhaps you might say socially, politically, legally. As a matter of fact, I'm thinking there should be a bumper sticker that says, enjoy free speech, thank a wobbly. The free speech fights, I think, were very inspirational when I've read about them. And something else, too, I was just, I think that probably if you talk about the founding convention, a lot of our listeners would be familiar with a lot of the people that attended it. In fact, I believe Mother Jones was there, and unfortunately there are conflicting Mother Jones and Wobbly events on the weekend of the 25th. Mount Olive is the Mother Jones Day celebration. Maybe if you could talk about a little bit about that convention, who was there, how it got together, perhaps some of the tensions. I believe there was a difference between socialists and the more anarcho-syndicalist factions, and also the idea of whether the IWW should participate in politics.
You had most of the leading figures in the radical labor movement of the day. So Eugene Debs was there, who was leader of the Socialist Party, ran for president several times on their ticket, and was thrown in jail for opposing World War I. Got over 1 million votes for president from his prison cell. You had Daniel De Leon, who was leader of the second largest Socialist Party, a pretty fierce opponent. But they came together to support the founding of the IWW because they both recognized the need for a different kind of a labor movement. Mother Jones, as you mentioned, was there. Lucy Parsons spoke at some length. She was the widow of Albert Parsons, who was hanged in 1887 for his work in the syndicalist movement in Chicago and fighting for the eight-hour day. Big Bill Haywood, who was quite active in the Western Federation of Miners, was the chair of the convention. William Troutman, who was the editor of the Brewery Workers Journal, was there. And pretty much anybody who was a major player in the more militant labor movement, particularly in the Midwest and West, where labor relations were somewhat rougher. The employers were more likely to call out the militia or gun thugs or such to attack unions, and then the unions and the workers were forced to respond in somewhat more aggressive ways. So, you had a wide array of people who were really very closely focused on fighting for better conditions, but recognized that to do that, you had to have a different model of unionism, one which united all workers, one which recognized that fundamentally the boss wasn't your friend. You were organizing because he was abusing and exploiting, and therefore you had to organize in a way that didn't sort of trust him to do the right thing, but built power. You had people like that, a number of them. You had people who believed strongly in electoral action. You had people who, to whom electoral action was quite irrelevant, perhaps because they disagreed with it in principle. Many of them because they weren't citizens. They were immigrants. The U.S. working class in 1905, you go back and look at census data, in the big cities, less than half the population were citizens. The people who were working in meatpacking plants and coal mining and textile, they were not born here. They were immigrants who were brought over, and to talk to them about electoral action or voting for a new regime, whether they agreed or not, it didn't matter. It had no impact on their actual lives. It wasn't something they could do. So you did have some tensions between people who favored electoral action, between people who favored industrial action at the point of production. And the IWW preamble was written to sort of encompass both approaches. It was amended in 1908 because those tensions continued. And in 1908, a reference to workers uniting on both the political and industrial field was altered to say that the IWW existed to organize workers on the industrial field. The political clause was dropped out, and that caused some more politically minded people to withdraw and pursue their agenda. A lot of other people who did believe in political action stayed in the union, figuring that they had a political party for their political action and a union for their industrial action.
Okay, John. Well, I was thinking maybe we could get back to Alexis, and she could tell us what's going on the weekend of June 25th, some of the events. What I've seen looks really interesting.
Great. Yeah. On the 25th and the 26th, Saturday and Sunday, we're having a conference at the University of Illinois at Chicago. The Saturday day is organized around history and what history can teach us about present-day organizing, so it's not all historical. There's a lot of mix in there about the modern-day labor movement. And then Sunday is organized around what we're calling alternative models of worker organizing. So it will be people from our campaigns and campaigns that we've paid attention to and talking about ways that workers can organize, like John said, in more effective ways than just relying on these government-sponsored elections. on the evening of the 25th on Saturday, we're also hosting a concert with a number of acts. I think there's 8, and it's a celebration of the latest edition of our songbook called. And the IWW is very well known for our songs, of course. So the concert is called "To Fan the Flames of Discontent," which is usually the subtitle of our songbook. The main title usually being the Little Red Songbook. And that's at the Preston Bradley Center and starts at 8 o'clock. And details of all these things can actually be found on the web at IWW.org/Chicago. So you can find it there, too.
Yeah, I just wanted to interject. I saw a couple of names that stuck out at me. One, our friend, friend to many people in Champaign, Central Illinois, from the mid-1990s when this area was called the Illinois War Zone. Ann Feeney will be appearing there. Mm-hmm. And she'll be appearing the night before in Mount Olive, so she's got a pretty busy weekend. And Utah Phillips, you know, he doesn't play much anymore. He doesn't get out much anymore. And this might be a good opportunity to see him.
Yes, it would be. Actually, speaking of Utah Phillips, Utah and John McCutcheon are actually playing at the Hot House on Thursday the 23rd in Chicago, which is a benefit for the IWW. So if you can't make the Saturday night, you can make the Thursday night.
Hey, that sounds pretty good. Could you mention maybe a few of the speakers who might be talking about alternative views or organizing and things like that?
Sure. Staunton Lind, who's a longtime labor activist, will be there. Peter Linebaugh, who's the author of The Many-Headed Hydra, will be coming. We have representatives from the Messengers campaign, the Truckers campaign, and the South Street Workers campaign, as well as our Starbucks campaign, which we didn't get to talk about yet, but they'll all be speaking. A number of academics, including John, will be giving talks about lessons that we can learn from IWW history. Norm Diamond, the former president of the Pacific Northwest Labor College, will be there. There's a whole list. Actually, if you go online starting on Friday, you'll be able to see that.
Okay. You mentioned the website and its address. Maybe you could repeat that, and possibly for our maybe less computer-enabled people, if there's any phone numbers.
Sure, absolutely. The website is, it's really easy to remember. It's www.iww.org, and you can find it from there, but you can go right to it by doing iww.org/Chicago. And then our phone number is also easy to remember, 215, that's the Philadelphia extension, 215-222-1905.
Well, okay, I think we should probably wrap this up, and then I'd like to thank you, Alexis, and you, John, for taking some time out after hours, I guess we should say, and telling us about the IWW and its anniversary.
Great, thanks for having us.
Well, anytime. I'm sure we'll be speaking in the future, and don't worry about the Starbucks campaign. We've been reporting on it.
Great.
And anyway, hope you both have a good evening.
Okay, same to you.
Thanks.